Nomoto presents American Presidents. President Lyndon Baines Johnson. Narrated with Microsoft Azure using the Ava voice. Running time, approximately 30 minutes. If you enjoy this program, explore the rest of our library. Every show is designed to stand alone, but together they form a larger project, a guided tour of the forces, intellectual, emotional, political, technological, that built the world we live in and the world we're about to enter. On the afternoon of November 22, 1963, aboard Air Force One on the tarmac in Dallas, a heavy-set man in a dark suit raised his right hand while his left rested on a small Bible. His face was set, grave, exhausted. Beside him stood Jacqueline Kennedy, still wearing her pink suit stained with the blood of her husband, the president who had been shot barely 2 hours earlier. A federal judge administered the oath. Reporters crowded the narrow cabin. Secret Service agents pressed against the walls. The engines hummed as if impatient to lift the plane into the sky. When it was over, the new president, Lyndon Baines Johnson, turned to the small cluster of witnesses and said simply, "Now, let's get airborne." That cramped swearing-in captured the essence of the moment and of the man. Johnson had not sought the presidency like this. He had dreamed of it, maneuvered for it, imagined it coming through the ballot box and convention deals, not through an assassin's rifle. Yet fate had dropped the office on his shoulders in a moment of national trauma. The country that had voted for John F. Kennedy now found itself led by a tall, gruff Texan whose accent, manner, and style seemed a world away from the cool elegance of the new frontier. Over the next 5.5 years, Lyndon Johnson would use that office to pass some of the most sweeping domestic reforms in American history and to drag the nation into the quagmire of Vietnam, leaving behind a legacy of towering achievement and deep division. To understand how he came to that cabin on Air Force One, we have to go back to the Texas Hill Country at the turn of the 20th century, to a small house without electricity or indoor plumbing, and to a boy who saw up close what poverty, pride, and politics could do to a family. Lyndon B. Johnson was born on August 27, 1908, near Stonewall, Texas, in a region of scrubby oak, rocky soil, and stubborn people. His father, Sam Ely Johnson Jr., had served in the Texas legislature and fancied himself a man of public importance, but he was chronically bad with money. He invested in cotton at the wrong moments, borrowed heavily, and watched his prospects rise and fall with the weather and the market. His mother, Rebecca Baines Johnson, was educated and ambitious, descended from a more prosperous line. She poured her energy into books, music, and social standing, sometimes at odds with the rough realities of life in the Hill Country. The family's fortunes fluctuated wildly. When Lyndon was small, they had hired help in parties. By his adolescence, the farm was failing, creditors were calling, and the Johnsons were nearly broke. These swings left marks. Johnson never forgot the humiliation of poverty, the patched clothes, the sense that neighbors were whispering about the fallen Johnsons, the worry that there might not be enough food. He also never forgot the power his father once had as a legislator, nor the impotence he later displayed when money ran out. From this mix came two core traits, a fierce determination never again to be poor and a conviction that government, properly used, could rescue people from circumstances that crushed them. For the rest of his life, he would measure policies not in abstract numbers, but in terms of whether they helped families like the ones he had grown up among in the Hill Country. As a schoolboy, Lyndon was energetic, restless, often disruptive. Teachers recognized his intelligence, but struggled to contain him. He could charm classmates one moment and bully them the next. Debate and argument came naturally. Authority attracted and repelled him. He wanted to lead, but he also resented anyone who tried to tell him no. By his late teens, he had developed the blend of charm, intimidation, and relentless attention to detail that would later be known as the Johnson treatment, leaning in close, towering over a colleague, cajoling, flattering, threatening, whatever it took to get agreement. education provided his first path out of the hill country. After graduating from high school in Johnson City, he worked briefly doing odd jobs in California, then returned home and enrolled at what is now Texas State University in San Marcos. He paid his way by working as a janitor and teaching at a small Mexican-American school in the town of Cotula. The children there were poor, marginalized, and often treated with open contempt by white Texans. Johnson later said that the faces of those students stayed with him all his life. He saw in their struggles the wasted potential of an entire group shut out by segregation and poverty. Decades later, when he pushed for civil rights and anti-poverty legislation, he would evoke Cotula as the place where he first understood the moral stakes. Politics drew him early. After college, he became a congressional aide in Washington, then returned to Texas to run the Texas branch of the National Youth Administration, a New Deal agency that gave young people work and training during the Great Depression. In that role, Johnson proved himself an energetic administrator and a tireless seeker of federal funds for his state. He also learned how power flowed through committees, offices, and personalities. He cultivated relationships with local bosses, businessmen, and the Roosevelt administration. He moved constantly, making calls late into the night, promising favors, filing reports, and always, always keeping score. In 1937, when a special election opened up a seat in Congress from Texas's 10th District, Johnson jumped in. He ran as an ardent New Dealer, promising to bring federal projects and relief to his rural constituents. He campaigned hard, flying around the district in borrowed planes, shaking hands at country stores and courthouses. He won, heading to Washington as one of the youngest members of the House. There he became a reliable ally of Franklin Roosevelt, supporting programs that brought electricity, dams, and jobs to places like the Hill Country. The Perdinales Electric Cooperative, which later brought lights to his own family's home, stood in his mind as proof that the federal government could literally illuminate the lives of the poor. World War II gave Johnson another platform. As a member of Congress, he obtained a Navy commission and briefly served in the Pacific, participating in a single dangerous air mission that earned him a Silver Star. The details of that mission would later be debated, but at the time the medal added a touch of wartime credibility to his resume. More importantly, the war accelerated the transformation of the federal government into a permanent presence in people's lives, something Johnson both recognized and intended to shape. Ambition pushed him toward the Senate. In 1941, he ran for a seat and lost in a bitter, possibly stolen contest. In 1948, he ran again, this time in a primary against the popular Texas governor, Coke Stevenson. The campaign was ferocious. Johnson used everything at his disposal: relentless organizing, modern advertising, support from labor and minorities in South Texas, and, according to many historians, some deeply dubious vote counting. The final margin, an infamous 78-vote edge in what became known as the Box 13 election, remains controversial. What is clear is that Johnson fought for every ballot, challenged adverse counts in court, and emerged as Landslide Lyndon, as a nickname that carried a bitter edge. Once in the Senate, he moved with astonishing speed. He studied its rules the way a chess master studies openings, learning how committees, seniority, and informal customs could be bent to his will. He cultivated older senators, listening more than he spoke at first, flattering egos, absorbing grudges. By 1951, he was the Senate's Democratic whip, and by 1955, he became the youngest majority leader in the chamber's history. He transformed what had been a relatively passive post into a powerful command center. He decided which bills came to the floor, who spoke when, how votes were counted, and what deals were made. Allies and adversaries alike talked about the Johnson treatment: the looming figure leaning over a desk, jabbing a finger into a chest, whispering promises of federal projects or threats of political isolation. On civil rights in the 1950s, Johnson walked a careful line. As a Southerner, he knew that his region clung fiercely to segregation. As a national leader, He saw that the country was changing and that open defiance of desegregation would tarnish America's image in the Cold War. In 1957, he helped shepherd through the first civil rights bill since Reconstruction. It was modest, focused mainly on protecting Black voting rights, and it was watered down significantly to avoid a filibuster. Yet its passage signaled that the federal government was edging back into the fight over race. Johnson later used the experience as a stepping stone toward far more ambitious civil rights laws when he became president. In 1960, John F. Kennedy chose Johnson as his running mate in part to balance the ticket geographically and politically. The young, charismatic senator from Massachusetts needed support in the South and among older, more conservative Democrats. Johnson, who had harbored his own presidential ambitions, accepted a job many saw as a step down from his powerful perch in the Senate. As vice president, he found himself marginalized, kept at arm's length by Kennedy's Harvard-educated inner circle. He attended funerals, headed commissions, and waited. Those who had watched him dominate the Senate were struck by how small his role now seemed. That changed in an instant in Dallas. When Kennedy was pronounced dead at Parkland Hospital, Secret Service agents insisted that Johnson be sworn in before Air Force One left Texas to ensure constitutional continuity. The photograph of that ceremony, the new president with his hand raised, Jackie beside him, is one of the starkest images in American political history. It introduced Lyndon Johnson to the world not as the master of Senate maneuvers, but as the man obligated to console a grieving nation and carry forward a fallen president's agenda. Johnson understood the symbolism and moved quickly to harness it. In his first speech to Congress just days after the assassination, he framed his presidency as a continuation of Kennedy's. "Let us continue," he said, using the phrase as both promise and command. But he also quietly expanded the scope of what continuing would mean, particularly on civil rights. Kennedy had proposed a sweeping civil rights bill, but it had been stalled in the Senate by Southern filibusters. Johnson, the former majority leader, knew exactly how to move it. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 became his first great test. Johnson used every tool he had honed over decades: personal appeals, threats to withhold federal projects, late-night phone calls, and appeals to national conscience. He partnered with Republican Senate leader Everett Dirksen, recognizing that Northern Republicans and Democrats together could outvote the segregationist bloc. The debate was brutal, the filibuster long and intense, but in July 1964, the bill passed. It outlawed segregation in public accommodations, banned employment discrimination on the basis of race, color, religion, sex, or national origin, and gave the federal government new powers to enforce desegregation. When Johnson signed it, he reportedly told an aide that Democrats had lost the South for a generation. He knew the political cost, but for the boy who had taught poor Mexican-American children in Kitula, the moral imperative outweighed party arithmetic. Later that year, he ran for president in his own right, facing Republican nominee Barry Goldwater, a conservative senator from Arizona who opposed much of the New Deal and the new civil rights law. Johnson's campaign portrayed Goldwater as reckless on nuclear weapons and extreme on domestic policy. The famous Daisy ad, which showed a little girl picking petals from a flower followed by a nuclear mushroom cloud, played only once but encapsulated the message. Johnson was stability and compassion. Goldwater was danger. The election ended in a landslide. Johnson won more than 60% of the popular vote and carried all but six states. For the first time, he had the full Democratic mandate he had long craved. With that mandate, he launched the Great Society, an ambitious program aimed at eradicating poverty, expanding education, improving health care, and enhancing the quality of life in America's cities and countryside. In his 1964 and 1965 speeches, he described a society where the meaning of freedom went beyond the right to vote or speak. It included the chance to develop one's talents, to escape hunger and ignorance, to live in dignity. Drawing on his own memories of rural poverty, He insisted that the richest nation on earth could afford to lift up its poorest citizens. The legislative outpouring that followed was extraordinary. In 1965, Johnson signed Medicare and Medicaid into law, creating health insurance programs for the elderly and the poor. He pushed through federal aid to elementary and secondary education, funneling resources into schools that had long gone neglected. He expanded food stamp programs, created Head Start for preschool children, and launched the Office of Economic Opportunity, which coordinated job training, community action programs, and legal services for the poor. Environmental laws on clean air and water, consumer protection measures, arts and humanities endowments. The list of great society achievements stretched across the policy landscape. Parallel to this war on poverty was a second great civil rights push. After the Civil Rights Act, the central remaining barrier to Black political power in the South was the systematic denial of the vote through literacy tests, poll taxes, intimidation, and procedural tricks. In early 1965, activists in Alabama organized marches and protests in Selma to highlight the issue. When state troopers brutally attacked peaceful marchers on the Edmund Pettus Bridge, an episode broadcast on national television as Bloody Sunday, the moral crisis could not be ignored. Johnson went before Congress in a televised address and invoked the movement's cry, "We shall overcome," aligning himself with a struggle many white Southerners saw as an existential threat to their way of life. The Voting Rights Act of 1965 followed, banning literacy tests and authorizing federal examiners to register voters in jurisdictions with a history of discrimination. Within a few years, Black voter registration in the South soared, transforming local and state politics. In these domestic achievements, Johnson reached the zenith of his influence. He had used the levers of power more effectively than any president since Franklin Roosevelt, arguably more effectively in the realm of civil rights than any president since Lincoln. He had, in many respects, made good on promises rooted in his Hill Country childhood and his New Deal apprenticeship. Yet even as the Great Society expanded, another struggle was consuming his attention and eroding his support: Vietnam. The American involvement in Vietnam predated Johnson. Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy had all taken steps to support anti-communist governments in Indochina, seeing the region through the Cold War lens of containment and domino theories. By the time Johnson took office, there were already thousands of U.S. military advisors in South Vietnam. The Viet Cong insurgency was growing. The South Vietnamese government was unstable and riddled with corruption. Johnson, who prided himself on his domestic agenda, saw Vietnam as a distraction, but also felt trapped by its logic. He feared that abandoning South Vietnam would expose him to charges of appeasement, embolden the Soviet Union and China, and unravel his credibility at home. In August 1964, reports emerged of attacks on U.S. ships in the Gulf of Tonkin. The details were murky. At least one of the reported attacks almost certainly did not happen as first described. But Johnson seized the moment to ask Congress for a resolution authorizing him to take all necessary measures to repel aggression and prevent further hostilities. The Gulf of Tonkin resolution passed overwhelmingly, effectively giving the president a blank check to escalate the war without a formal declaration. Johnson presented it as a limited, defensive measure. In reality, it became the legal framework for a massive expansion of American military involvement. From 1965 onward, U.S. troop levels in Vietnam climbed rapidly, from tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands. Johnson approved sustained bombing campaigns against North Vietnam, hoping to pressure its leaders into negotiations, and deployed ground troops to protect key areas in the South. He refused, however, to fully mobilize the American economy or call up large numbers of reserves, trying to fight the war without disrupting his domestic programs. Guns and butter became the shorthand. He wanted both victory abroad and reform at home. The war did not cooperate. The enemy was resilient, accepting heavy casualties while continuing to infiltrate and fight. American commanders measured progress in body counts and search and destroy missions. Television brought home images of jungle combat, burning villages, and wounded soldiers. Casualties mounted, and progress remained elusive. As early as 1965 and 1966, some advisors warned Johnson that the war might be unwinnable at an acceptable cost. He listened, agonized, and escalated anyway, convinced that retreat would be politically and strategically catastrophic. At home, opposition grew. Students protested at universities, religious leaders denounced the war on moral grounds, and civil rights activists like Martin Luther King Jr. linked Vietnam to broader critiques of American racism and imperialism. Johnson, once the master of consensus, found himself facing a fractured public. The same television networks that had broadcast his triumphs in civil rights legislation now aired nightly footage of combat and chaos. The draft, which fell heavily on working class and minority young men, fed resentment and anger. The turning point came in early 1968 with the Tet Offensive. During the Vietnamese Lunar New Year ceasefire, Viet Cong and North Vietnamese forces launched coordinated attacks across South Vietnam, including assaults on major cities and even the U.S. Embassy compound in Saigon. Militarily, Tet was a failure for the communists. They suffered enormous casualties and did not hold their gains. Politically, it was devastating for Johnson. Americans, told that victory was near, watched as the war exploded on their screens. The gap between official optimism and visible reality widened into a chasm. Influential news anchor Walter Cronkite, after visiting Vietnam, concluded on air that the war appeared mired in stalemate. Johnson reportedly remarked that if he had lost Cronkite, he had lost Middle America. Meanwhile, the social fabric was fraying. Urban riots erupted in several cities in the mid-1960s, fueled by police brutality, segregation, and economic frustration. Some white voters, especially in the North, turned away from Johnson's party, resenting what they saw as disorder and favoritism toward minorities. The Great Society's programs, while beneficial to millions, became easy targets for critics who portrayed them as bloated or ineffective. Johnson found himself squeezed between a left furious about Vietnam and a right angry about civil rights and social change. By 1968, the political pressure was intense. Senator Eugene McCarthy challenged Johnson for the Democratic nomination on an anti-war platform and performed unexpectedly well in the New Hampshire primary. Robert Kennedy entered the race, drawing huge crowds with a message of ending the war and healing racial divisions. Johnson, exhausted and increasingly isolated, faced the prospect of a bruising inter-party fight. On March 31, 1968, he addressed the nation in a televised speech announcing a partial bombing halt over North Vietnam and a willingness to seek peace talks. At the end of the speech, in a line that stunned the country, he said he would not seek and would not accept his party's nomination for another term. In private, he had concluded that the country needed healing and that his own presence, so associated with Vietnam, made that impossible. He retired to his ranch in the Hill Country, a place he had filled with phones, televisions, and visitors during his presidency, but which now became a refuge and, in some ways, a prison. He watched the rest of 1968 unfold. The assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., the murder of Robert Kennedy, the chaos at the Democratic Convention in Chicago, and the election of Richard Nixon, who campaigned on a promise of law and order and a secret plan to end the war. Johnson's final years were a mix of pride and regret. He took satisfaction in the tangible results of his domestic programs. Elderly people with health care who had never had it before, children in Head Start classrooms, Black voters casting ballots in southern towns where they had once been barred. He knew that Medicare and Medicaid, the Civil Rights Act, and the Voting Rights Act would endure. At the same time, he was haunted by Vietnam, by the names of the dead, by the knowledge that his decisions had torn at the fabric of the country he had wanted so badly to lift up. Yet to leave Johnson there, as a man defined only by the tragic collision of war and reform, would miss something essential about how he exercised power day to day. He believed politics was a face-to-face business. He prowled the halls, grabbed lapels, worked phones until midnight. Senators remembered being backed into a corner, Johnson leaning over them, his nose inches away, reciting vote counts from memory, promising dams, post offices, or appointments for allies and slow death for obstructionists. Staffers saw another side as well. The man who would call an aide into his office not just to bark orders, but to ask about a sick parent or a child starting school, storing each detail away for future use. His methods could be manipulative, even ruthless, but underneath was a conviction that government only worked if someone took responsibility for pushing and pulling it into motion. He also carried an almost physical sense of time. Coming from a poor rural background and rising through the brutal ladder of Texas politics, Johnson was acutely aware that windows of opportunity open and close quickly. After his landslide victory in 1964, he told associates that they had maybe a year, two at most, before the coalition that made such sweeping change possible began to fray. That urgency drove the furious pace of legislation in 1965 and 1966. It also contributed to his refusal to back away from Vietnam. He feared that admitting failure abroad would shatter the authority he needed to protect what he had built at home. In that calculation lay the seeds of his undoing. The more he escalated the war to preserve his domestic achievements, the more the war consumed the trust and resources those achievements required. For all his flaws, there was a rough, unvarnished empathy in Johnson. He did not come to questions of poverty, race, or education as abstractions. He knew the feel of hard ground under cheap shoes, the shame in a parent's eyes when the bills could not be paid, the way condescension from the well-off could sting. When he spoke of building a society where the hungry are fed, the sick are cared for, the lonely are not alone, he was not reading lines written by staff. He was reaching back across decades to the boy standing in a dark farmhouse listening to his parents argue about debts. That memory ran like a current beneath every bill he pushed, every arm he twisted, and every speech he gave. It could not redeem the damage of Vietnam, but it explains why, long after his name became a synonym for a lost war, millions of Americans continued to live longer, vote more freely, and learn more fully in a country reshaped by his relentless, conflicted, very human drive to use power for change. He did not live long in retirement. Years of heavy smoking, stress, and heart trouble caught up with him. On January 22, 1973, just days after Nixon announced a ceasefire agreement in Vietnam, Lyndon Baines Johnson died at his ranch, the hill country sky stretching vast and indifferent above him. For listeners following this long procession of presidents, Johnson stands as a figure of stark contrasts. He was a man of the soil who mastered the machinery of government, a white Southerner who, more than any other 20th century president, forced the nation to confront its racial injustices, a champion of the poor who presided over a war that drained resources and trust, a legislative genius whose foreign policy choices undermined his own domestic legacy. Walk through the programs that still shape American life: Medicare, Medicaid, federal aid to schools, civil rights protections, voting rights enforcement, and Johnson's fingerprints are everywhere. Walk through the memorials and lists of the Vietnam dead, and his shadow falls there too. In the end, Lyndon B., Johnson's presidency is not a simple success or failure. It is a reminder that power, even in the hands of someone who understands its workings better than almost anyone, cannot control all the forces that swirl through history. He built a great society on the home front while a distant war ate away at its foundations. His life, from the rocky fields of the hill country to the polished wood of the Oval Office and back again, tells us that politics is not the art of the ideal, but the struggle to wrest something decent from a world of hard choices, mixed motives, and unintended consequences.